The second message about redemptive relating in our community series explores how God is for us. In that way, we exist to enjoy and share the love and message of God with everyone. So God is for us so that we can be for Him and the people in our lives. Here's Pastor Seth.
All right, I want you to think for a minute about the word with. With. Who in your life, as you look back on your life, what faces come to mind of somebody who has been with you? With you no matter what. With you through thick and thin. With you when you're doing great. With you even when you're not doing so great. With you when you've been successful. And with you when you've been a failure. There are probably not too many faces that come to mind with that. That's a pretty rare quality. Now, the face that probably did not come to mind, to maybe all of us, is God's face. The face of Jesus. Nobody like is with us like He is. We talked about this last week. And when we sense and believe that He is with us no matter what, you and I have a chance to reflect what with means to the people in our life. That affects how we relate to people. The first preposition we've looked at over there in the corner at the bottom of the banner there is with. God is with us profoundly. The whole point of the gospel is to come and be with His people, for us to be with Him, and then now we have a chance to be people who are like little audio visual pictures of what God is like. The desire to be with people, with you. Today we're going to look at the next one, which is for you. Now think again about who would you say in your life is somebody that you would say, that guy or that lady, they were for me. No matter what, through the thick and thin, through the highs and lows, through your successes and failures, It's just there's something coming out of that person's heart that just you just sense, no matter what, I am for you. And again, even though I just asked you this about a minute ago, it's likely that the face of Jesus was probably not the first face that came to your mind. Probably a human face. But what we get in those few human faces where we sense somebody is profoundly for me no matter what, is what should rise up in our heart is that what God is like? Is that what it means that God is for us? Am I getting a little glimpse of what this big picture is like, that he's for me? Answer is yes. Now let's look at some illustrations from the Old Testament, the New Testament. Try to put the cookies on the bottom shelf. God is for us, and this goes back as far as the creation story. You know, for a long time, I read Genesis 1 almost more like a detective, trying to mark out, now, what happened on day 1, and what happened on day 2, and what happened on day 3, and trying to run cross-references on there, and could day 4 really follow day 3 and day 5? But instead, what you're supposed to do is read Genesis 1 more like a poet is writing a poem, a love poem, or a lover is penning a letter, or I think most poignantly, it's an entry of a father's diary when he thinks back upon first Christmas with his kids. Now, let's look at this. Genesis 1:26. God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea, birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, over all the creatures that move along the ground." Now, by the time we get to this point in the story, we've already been through 5 days of creation. But in each day, even though the Bible says, and it was good, there's something missing from the story. There's one day where you can imagine at nighttime the panoply of stars and galaxies that you can see, like when you're in a place up in the Rocky Mountains at night, and you can just see the wonder of all this. But what would it be like for you to be on vacation and to look at that sense of wonder all around you at night and not be able to turn to somebody and say, "It's magnificent, isn't it?" And to share the wonder of what you're seeing. Or imagine going on vacation to the Grand Canyon. You drive all the way over there, you get out of your car, it's sunset, and you can see over the horizon, the sun is setting. You look down into the wonder of the canyon, the strata of rocks, the Colorado River below. You're filled with wonder, but you turn, and there's nobody really with which to share that moment, to share the beauty and strength of that at the moment. Something is missing. And that's what we have in this story until verse 26. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Now again, read this like a father who's just watched his wife give birth to their first child. That's kind of what's going on here. God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created. I can remember back to that day, back in August, 1981. The birth of my oldest. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful. Increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, over every living creature that moves on the ground." Do you hear something of the joy of a father? "I got you a car. I'm sending you to Harvard. I got you a job down at the plant. You're going to like it." Something of that joy here. Then God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant." Wow, wheat, oats, barley, alfalfa. "On the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit with seed in it." Watermelon, cantaloupe, strawberries, raspberries. You sense the heart of a poet, of a creator, who's thinking of all the different things that would just bring delight to his children. That's what we're reading here. And then in verse 30, I think of this as, again, don't read this as like a detective would. read this with a sense of how the Creator thinks about this. This next part is, it's almost like he's not going to speak to the beasts, the animal kingdom. Verse 30. To all the beasts of the earth and all the birds of the air and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has breath in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. Verse 31. God saw all he had made, and it was very good. It wasn't very good till Adam and Eve showed up. Then it was very good. Now, do you sense four coming out of these verses? Do you sense the heart of a father for his newborn son or his one-year-old son? 27-year-old daughter? That's what we're reading here in Genesis 1. Now think about this for yourself. It's one thing to think of God is for me, and in your head you know that, but how much does that really grip you? Think about a scale of 1 to 100. 1 meaning, good thought, maybe I'll think about this next year. 100 meaning, I'm anchored that God is for me. That anchors me. Now, maybe you think of 1 to 25, maybe, or 1 to 100, maybe I'm 25. I think about that some. God is for me. It's a good thought. I think about it the most when my life probably is going pretty well. Not too many problems. Yeah, God's for me. Or maybe you would say 1 to 100, I would say probably 50. Sometimes I know that. I know that. And other times I kind of get knocked off the horse some. Not really sure. I have questions and doubts. And I guess when I see other people or sometimes me going through some tough times. Or maybe you'd say 75. For the most part, I'm anchored in four. God is for me. But there are times where I go through something really, really rough. And it seems like my anchor has suddenly gotten up from the bottom of the sea and is now adrift with the waves. And there I go with it. What would it be like to be at 100? I'd like to get there someday. Hope to be there. Don't know how close I'll be. How do we get from 25 or 50 or 75 and keep moving that way? Well, we have pictures of this in your handout. Look into page 2. One of the pictures of this is that God is for us in the same way that a father is for his children. There's probably nothing like parenting that gives you a picture of what it means to be for somebody. You have this little kid that is like minutes old, and that kid can do absolutely really nothing for you, can't talk, can't express itself, can't say thank you for bringing life to me, can't do anything. It just sits there. And I'm sorry to say this, and I would say this about my own birth picture. You know, most of us after we're born, we're just not looking that good. Just saying. I was 10 pounds, 11 ounces. My mother was 5'4". No, 5'2". 5'2". She told me that the nurses, you know, when they put the babies back in and they had a nickname for me. Tarzan. I've seen a baby picture of me. That's it. But it doesn't really matter how ugly that kid is. You are for that kid. You are for that kid. Now, if you want a picture of this, just watch Devin and Davis out around the donut table when we're done and he's out there. You will see an audio-visual picture of what it means for someone, for God, to be for a person. It's almost like that's the only person you see. So the only person that really matters. You could be, there could be 1,000 people here today. But Pop is going to have his eyes on his kid. That's four. Now here's the delightful thing about this. You won't even have to think about it. And it will happen. Paul talks about this in Romans 8. You did not receive a spirit that makes you a slave again to fear. You received the spirit of sonship. You were made part of the family. And by him we cry, Abba, Father, which in Aramaic means daddy. Daddy, daddy. And you're going to see some of our little ones out there a little bit. Daddy, daddy. That's the effect of four. Kids aren't going to be thinking about, does daddy love me? Does daddy reject me? Am I good enough for daddy? The effect of four is to relax and know that somebody delights in you. Romans 8:16, the Spirit himself testifies with our spirit, we are God's children. And Paul tells us that we've been adopted into the family. Now, many of you know, of course, most of you know Lance, our worship leader, who's away this weekend. He was adopted. And then Mandy Houck, if you're around, back before 06, you know Mandy. She was adopted too. It's interesting to talk to these two folks about being adopted. Because what it, you might think, but am I really the blood kid? Is there something that I'm not quite there with the blood kid? Well, those questions may arise. But the thing that trumps that question is, I was already alive and chosen. Somebody saw me and wanted me. Now, that's the picture here of adoption with how God has done this with us. If we are children, then we are heirs. Not just some kid off the street, bring him in, he needs a meal. You know, we'll take care of him until he gets on his feet. No, legal heir. Heirs of God and co-heirs with Christ. So if God had made a will and he was going to give everything to Jesus Christ, when you came along as one of his kids, he would have to go to his attorney and say, we need to redo the will. We need to add Tom in, his name. We need to add Autumn in. We need to add Jack in. Along with Jesus? That's what he says. That's four. If God is for us, this is probably the greatest passage on this in the New Testament, Romans 8:31. And in this passage, Paul asks a series of rhetorical questions. A rhetorical question is a question that's not meant for an answer. It is so over the top obvious what the answer is that you usually just sort of go, yeah, I know. You really can't answer that question. It's so obvious. Everybody knows the answer to that. First two questions. Verse 31. What then shall we say to this? Now, what's the this? He's talked about adoption into God's family. We are heirs and co-heirs. And the verses just before this one, his people have been saved from their sin. He is in the process of making us like Christ. He's going to bring us home one day, and we're going to spend eternity in heaven. Now, as if all of that is not enough to sway us about this issue of four, and apparently we need more. Next question. If God is for us, who is against us? Now, there are different kinds of ifs in the Greek language. This is not the if of, well, I hope this is true. This is more of the if of, since this is true, then. If God is for us, there's the four, who is against us? Who is against us? Now, here he makes a contrast. God is for us. He says, who are the people that are against you? Now, maybe some people come to mind. Maybe bullies at school. Or maybe a boss. Or maybe you've had some people that work for you. Or neighbors. Or extended family members where there's drama and issues. Whoever comes to mind, if God is for us, who is against us? Meaning, it really doesn't matter who those people are and what they do. If those people slander you to others, that still doesn't outweigh that God is for me. If people hold malice in their heart and say malicious things about me, that still doesn't hold a candle to God being for me. If people think that I didn't come through and I wasn't faithful to what I said I would do, and that's what they believe, still doesn't hold a candle to that God is for me. If people think that I'm an enemy, or that I'm just a person of cunning, or question my motives, still doesn't outdo that God is for me. Verse 32. He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, will he not also give us all things with him? I says, he who did not spare. That's an interesting phrase. In the Greek language and in our English culture, what does it mean to not spare something? Well, I think about an event, the cost of an event. Sometimes there's an event, maybe it's a wedding or a big party or a New Year's Eve party or something like that, a going away party for somebody, a retirement party, and we say, no expense was spared. Meaning that all the way down to even those little napkin rings that sat at the table, somebody was even willing to put money towards those because expense was not an issue. The event or the person we're celebrating was the issue, so no expense was spared. Really, it doesn't matter what the cost was, no matter how great the cost. That's part of what's sort of included here in this question. He who did not spare his own son, that's costly. It's costly to the son, it's also costly to the father. We use the word, the phrase, he who did not spare, in another way too, in our culture. I want you to picture it's midnight. It's folks are standing around the outside of the prison door. TV cameras are rolling. There are two groups of people there. There's one group of people who have somebody that they know, they're related to, that's on death row and is supposed to be executed at midnight. That's one group. And there are some usually some protesters about the death penalty who are kind of around them. You've got news people interviewing some of these folks. The second group you've got, usually a smaller group, are the people who the mother and father say of the teenage girl who was brutally raped and murdered. That's a smaller group. Our culture's not as interested in these people, usually, as these people. Now, why are they there at midnight? Midnight. Because what's going on is they're all waiting for or trying to answer this question. Will there be a call from the governor? Will there be a stay of execution? Will this convict be spared the death penalty? Now, that's the same kind of language Paul uses here. He who did not spare his own son. The governor didn't pick up the phone. God didn't call Pontius Pilate and say, I just can't do it. I can't do it. Let him go. The phone sat right there. He said, I can't do it. I can't pick up the phone. He didn't pick up the phone to call the Roman soldiers. I can't pick it up. Didn't call the religious leaders. You guys know what you're doing? You can't do this. Didn't pick up the phone. He didn't call anybody. He had to let the clock come up towards 11:57, 58, 59, and the clock struck midnight. The son is not spared. He's going to die. That's what Paul brings to image here. He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all. And here's the rhetorical question. Will he not also give us all things with him? Verse 33. He who shall bring any charge against God's elect. Now he switches the imagery to a courtroom. Imagine you are the defendant sitting in the courtroom. And the district attorney walks in. And he's got his long list of things that he's going to, charges he's going to bring against you. He stands up. And he says, Your Honor, members of the jury, meaning you as the defendant, this person is a scoundrel. No good. An adulterer. A liar. A thief. They've broken every one of the Ten Commandments. Hypocrite. Courtroom gets real silent. Suddenly the judge speaks up. Verse 33 continues, it is God who justifies. Meaning, God says, Mr. District Attorney, sit down. We've already had the trial. Trial's over. Where were you? You're a little bit too late for this. What kind of charge are you going to bring? We've already acquitted the defendant. He's free among the populace. That's the first image. And he says, who is to condemn? Meaning, who's going to come into court as a witness? And the district attorney is going to get that witness up there. He's going to revile your name and bring character assassination to you. Who is to condemn? Is it Christ Jesus who died? Yes. Who was raised from the dead? Who is at the right hand of God? And what is he saying there? He's saying what happens here is when the witnesses get up to testify against you, God says, oh, wait a minute. Hold it right here. Mr. Witness, Miss Witness, please go sit down. Mr. District Attorney, what kind of attorney are you? You brought 7 charges against the defendant. Any idiot just out of law school could have done that. I happen to know that there are thousands of charges you could have brought against this defendant. And you bring 7 and act like that's some big deal? It is Christ Jesus who died, yes, who is raised from the dead. In other words, it really doesn't matter how many charges are brought against you, whether it's just a handful or thousands. The penalty's been paid, the whole thing. Who indeed intercedes for us, meaning Jesus. Indeed intercedes for us. Now, what does he mean here? Something like this. Third picture in the courtroom. The DA is standing up, making a complete idiot of himself. And the judge says to him, did you happen to miss the defense attorney's closing arguments? Where were you? Were you down at the deli having a sandwich? You should have been here. You would have been dumbfounded. You wouldn't look like such a fool right now. The defense attorney has already interceded on behalf of the defendant. Trial's done. Where did you go to law school? Who gave you that diploma? If I had anything to do with this, I think I'd have you disbarred. That's the tenor of these verses. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Now, as if all of these things should have been enough to convince us about the foreness of God. God knows our human nature. And we're going to try to find something, usually, that will sort of put a chink in the armor that God is really for me. And I think that the devil's masterstroke is suffering. When we go through times of suffering. So Paul addresses this. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation? Distress? Persecution, famine, nakedness, peril, meaning danger, or sword. He takes 7 huge items from around this circle and says, pick one. Will I do it? Will that unhook the anchor from the bedrock of your heart that God is for you? And again, there's two rhetorical questions here, but really, you could say there are about 8 rhetorical questions in there. Persecution? Famine? Not even that. Peril? Not even that. Verse 36. As it is written, for thy sake we are being killed all the day long. We are regarded as sheep to be slaughtered. In other words, he takes one of these things, persecution, and he puts some words to it. This is what it's like to go through suffering with persecution. This is how it seems. For thy sake, meaning God's sake, we are being killed all the day long. We are regarded as sheep to be slaughtered. If you want to think about this in today's terms, think about our brothers and sisters who are in the Middle East or in Africa. Now, as bad as all those things are, verse 37, he says, no, none of those things. In all these things, it's almost like he's given up trying to give examples that we might find an excuse. He says, all these things. We are more than conquerors through him who loved us. But then it's almost like he knows our human nature too well, and he can think of some more exception clauses that we would come up with. But in my case, I'm not so sure God is for me. So he says, I am sure neither death nor life nor angels nor principalities nor things present nor things to come nor powers nor height nor depth nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus. He finally adds the et cetera to the list. Four. Now, if you've been a Christian for a while, none of this is really new to you. You go, yeah, I know that. Yeah, I got that. Got that in my head. Problem is, I got it in my head, but when I walk out those doors back into the real world in which I live, it's likely to remain mostly in my head and not so much in my heart. Now, how do we get that God is for me in my head down into God is for me in my heart? And here is the wonder of how he uses his people in our lives. This will be watching Devin and Davis out there. This will be watching some of our husbands with their wife out in the foyer. You're going to get a picture of what it means, little pictures of what it's like that God is for us. Let me give you a couple examples from Philippians. Paul says, I hope in the Lord to send Timothy to you soon, that I may be cheered when I receive news about you. Then listen to this. I have no one else like him who takes a genuine interest in your welfare. Now, he was leading a mission team, a church planting team. They were on the move, country to country. I have no one else like him who takes a genuine interest in your welfare. Everyone looks out for his own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. Timothy is a picture of what it means to be for somebody. That's the effect that he has. People sense, Paul senses, this is a guy who is for you. His fundamental attitude is, I am for you. And another example, I think it necessary to send back to you Epaphroditus, my brother, fellow worker, fellow soldier, who is also your messenger, whom you sent to take care of my needs. He longs for all of you and is distressed because you heard he was ill. How often does that happen? He was distressed because he heard you, because you thought he was ill. Indeed, he was ill and almost died. Therefore, I am all the more eager to send him so that when you see him again, you may be glad and I may have less anxiety. Welcome him in the Lord with great joy. Honor men like him because he almost died for the work of Christ, risking his life to make up for the people you could not give me. Epaphroditus is one of those choice people who gets it. He is for the people who are standing in front of him. Wherever he goes, that is how he's leaning into them. What he wants the people to sense is, I am for you. Don't you have to use those words? You just sense that's coming out of his heart. Where does that come from? It comes from because of the belief that God is for me no matter what. On the back of your handout, let's look at one last illustration. This issue of being for somebody is at its most powerful when somebody has failed. Let's look at an example of this. Jesus is talking to his disciples. This is just before he's about to be arrested. This night, very night, you will all fall away on account of me, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the shepherd of the flock will be scattered, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. Now, Peter understands this, and he is baffled by this. And he's more than baffled, he is irritated. And I'd say he's more than irritated, he is one angry guy. In essence, what he hears is, I'm going to go through, Jesus saying, I'm going to go through the worst of the worst. And when it finally comes to somebody standing with me and being for me, you guys are going to run like chickens. Peter replied, verse 33, even if all fall away, meaning the other 10 that were standing next to him, having masterfully thrown them all under the bus, even if all fall away on account of you, I never will. Now, I believe he really meant that. That's how it seemed to him. That's how it felt to him. That's how he looked at himself. I tell you the truth, Jesus said, this very night before the rooster crows, you will disown me 3 times. Peter declared, even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you. That's how it felt. That's how it seemed. That's what he thought. The next few moments, Jesus is arrested. He's taken up, and all the disciples, just like the scriptures say, scattered like chickens. And then Peter got a hold of himself, and he follows the crowd into the city in the night darkness and in the shadows. And he goes outside where Jesus is being interrogated, just inside the house, open windows there, and he sits at a courtyard around a fire, warming himself, trying to be incognito. He can see that the interrogation's going on, and a person comes up to him and says, hey, I know you. You were with him. So you got the wrong guy, not me. Somebody else comes up and says, you're a Galilean. I recognize your voice. No, you got the wrong guy, not me. Me and him. And then we come to the climax in verse 60. He's asked a third time, man, I don't know what you're talking about. And Mark adds an interesting thing here. It says, Mark adds that Peter brought down curses upon himself. Something along this line. Man, I'd be damned if I knew that guy. They're interrogating him there. How dare you accuse me of that? Now, it's almost like it's one of those moments where all of life just stops. The next thing that happens is the rooster crows. It's probably not 6 a.m. when the rooster crows. It's probably somewhere in the middle of the night. Roosters don't crow in the middle of the night. As he was speaking, the rooster crowed, verse 61. The Lord, who was inside the house, turns, looks through the open window into the courtyard, and looks straight at Peter. What was on that look? What would you read in those eyes? What would you read in that countenance? Think about when you failed, and imagine if suddenly you make eye contact with Jesus. What look do you see on his face? Then Peter remembered the word the Lord had spoken to him. Before the rooster crows today, you will disown me 3 times. Now, what does he realize about himself? The rooster is like DNA evidence. It removes all doubt about what just happened. Peter in the future couldn't say, well, I just kind of slipped up. Tongue got the best of me. I just panicked. Poor choice of words. What the rooster crowing is identified with when Jesus talks to him is the word disown. Now, I've got a friend of mine who's an attorney who does estate planning. And on occasion, there are family members that come in, usually older folks, grandfatherly types, and they want to disown a child or more. And my friend, who's been around the block a few times on this, usually takes the stance of trying to find out what has precipitated this and is trying to talk them out of this because this is serious stuff. This is the kind of stuff that lingers on for years and down through generations. And the rifts and splits in families can go on and on and on. But that's the word here. Peter realizes that is what he just did. He disowned Jesus. Cut him out of the will. I don't know him. What look did he see on the face of Jesus? The next thing Luke records is he went outside and wept bitterly. Now, when you and I fail, what I think happens is, without knowing it, is there's some look that we just sort of assume Jesus has toward us. And the look that I sort of usually go to, unfortunately, is sort of this, not again kind of look. What am I going to do with you kind of look. That's kind of the go-to look. It's easy when I was a younger Christian to think that about myself. The older I get, you know, I think about just how stupid that is. Completely misses the point of the gospel. What kind of look is it? Can I really believe that that look is a look of compassion? That the eyes that meet mine are saying something like, I'm still for you. I still believe in you. You are still of value to me. Now you might think, I think that's a stretch for me. I'd like to believe that. I'd like to know that. What if you knew, like Peter, that Jesus already knew you were going to fail ahead of that look? Would that make any difference to you? And let's say you say, okay, I'll buy that. He knows I'm going to fail. And in spite of my failure, when I look across there and meet his eyes, I'm going to see a look of compassion that fundamentally says, I am still for you. But the next thing you and I will do is, but I know that God could probably never use my life like he once did. And probably what you're going to be tempted to do is hang your head spiritually. I guess I should drag myself to church this morning. Maybe I'll wait till 9:45 when I can just kind of jump in the back. Maybe I'll sit in the cry room, leave before we get done. I don't want anybody to see me. I'll sit on the back row. I hope nobody asks me about what's going on in my life or how I'm doing. Maybe that's how we think. Well, there's something else I think he remembered. The last verse we'll look at, verse 32. I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And notice how he finishes here. When you have turned back, strengthen your brothers. What's all this talk about birds flying and they can't fly as high and they have a broken wing? Nonsense! What's this about hanging your head, just kind of walking around spiritually moping about? Nonsense! What's this about dragging yourself in and sitting in the cry room and hoping nobody else notices you or sitting on the back, maybe with somebody else? Nonsense! What he says here is, stand up! Get on your horse. You're needed in the fight. That is F-O-R. Let's pray together. Father, give us ears to hear what you're saying to us from start to finish. And if there's nothing we take away from today, help us take away that you are fundamentally for us, no matter how our circumstances look, no matter what kind of suffering we may be involved in, or what kind of drama, or what kind of heartache. None of those things trump that you are for us. And as we grasp that, would you give us eyes to see that as we relate to the people in our lives, they need to see this in us. That we are fundamentally, unequivocally for them, no matter what.
You hear me when I call. You are my morning song. Though darkness fills the night, it cannot hide the light. Whom shall I fear? You crush the enemy underneath my feet. You are my sword and shield.
We at Pacific Church of Irvine invite you to join us every Sunday at 9:30. You can also visit our website at pacificchurch.com.